House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 1st, 2015. First, we're going to jump out of schedule just a little bit, and we'll go to House Bill 2025, open a public hearing, and call Representative Caddy, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2025 comes to us from the Committee on Health Care. The bill allows persons participating in driving under the influence of intoxicants diversion to continue usage of medical marijuana, provided the person is otherwise authorized by law. There are no amendments before us today, and we do not yet have the paperwork on this bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Olson and Williamson, members of the committee. I'm Caddy McHugh, and I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast. I represent parts of Coos County, Douglas County, Lane County, and Lincoln County. And I come before you today to bring a bill on behalf of a constituent of mine from Lane County. Her name is Cheryl Smith. She asked that I draft House Bill 2025 to address a concern that has come to her attention. She's unable to make the drive to Salem today, so I'm just here on her behalf to present this bill to you. I thank you very much for your consideration of this bill on my constituent's behalf.
Thank you very much.
Great. Chair,
I'm not sure you know the answer to this, but do you know how under these circumstances other medications are covered and when somebody's in a diversion program, like narcotic drugs, opioids, and other drugs?
Yes. I am not an attorney, and I'm not an expert on this particular statute. I do understand that there are certain exemptions for drugs that people can use and be accepted into a diversion program, and those are drugs that are written by a physician, if I understand it correctly.
Maybe. I was just wondering whether staff has any information.
I do. Yes, there is an exemption in there that exists if there are drugs that are being prescribed by a physician or used as prescribed. They can still use them in diversion.
So they could be on Oxycontin, for example, something like that.
Yes, if it's prescribed and used exactly as prescribed.
Thank you, Representative.
And Chair Barker, I would just like to comment on how dapper you look this afternoon, and I wanted to wish you a very, very happy birthday. You brightened our day today.
I see she's trying to move her bill.
I told him he looks like a head waiter.
He wants a cupcake.
Yeah.
Well, I already had cake. Thank you.
Anthony Taylor, Molly McGrew. Go ahead and need your order. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Molly McGrew. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Cannabis Political Action Committee.
Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify in support of House Bill 2025. This is a straightforward bill that allows people who have entered into a diversion program to continue using medical marijuana while completing that program. Current statute already allows for people to take controlled substances with a valid prescription, as well as allowing the use of non-prescription medication and sacramental wine. Adding medical marijuana to these exceptions is both compassionate and consistent with the current operation of the program. Current law also provides for strong response by the courts should the person be caught or convicted of the same offense again. We thank the members of the House Health Care Committee for bringing this bill forward. The Oregon Canvas PAC urges you to send House Bill 2025 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. It is a bill that my name is Anthony Taylor, and I represent Compassionate Oregon, a patient advocacy group that advocates for medical marijuana patients, their families, and the communities that serve them. Cheryl brought this to my attention a year or so ago, because one of her patients at the Compassion Center in Eugene was had struggled to find a diversion program that would allow her the use of her medical cannabis during the diversion program. But once the once a ruling had come down from the court that medical marijuana is simply recommended, not actually a prescription, the diversion company organization refused her request to be able to allow cannabis. So this is really kind of a small bill, but it speaks to a much speaks to a much larger issue, and that is the issue of discriminating against people simply because they use medical marijuana or they have a medical marijuana card. You know, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act clearly states that cannabis should be considered as a medicine and treated as such. This does state that a person may use intoxicants during the diversion period if the person consumes sacramental wine or has a valid prescription for a substance and the person takes a substance as directed. So we feel adding this criteria should be kind of a no-brainer in the sense that if it, we're going to treat it as medicine, then why should we discriminate it when we clearly allow other medications to be used during the diversion program? We can quibble over the fact that it talks about prescriptions and you can't a doctor can't really prescribe cannabis, but they can direct a patient in the use for recommended conditions. So this whole idea of discriminating against people because they have a medical marijuana card or they use medical marijuana really came to light during this summer's Early Learning Council's actions to adopt a policy that completely prohibited medical marijuana card holders from being daycare providers. And bills like or rules like that, you know, really speak to the community and say that that not only are we asking you to step to the back of the bus, but we're asking you to get off the bus completely. This is unconscionable by policymakers to put these kind of discriminatory policies in place, and we would just hope that the committee will take this into consideration. I think that letting this bill fade into obscurity, you know, kind of makes us all complicit in this type of discrimination, and I think we need to keep taking steps to break down these barriers of inequality, and so we would urge the committee to support this bill and to send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Any questions, committee? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Robert Hayes, Rachel Salway, and Troy Costales.
Me first?
All right. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Hayes. I am employed as a patrol sergeant with the Albany Police Department. I'm a certified drug recognition expert and a drug recognition expert instructor. I am also a crash reconstructionist and was certified as a crash reconstructionist in 2005. In my 23 years as a police officer, I've conducted numerous investigations regarding motor vehicle crashes and impaired driving. I also teach at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and the classes I instruct are in regards to impaired driving and crash investigations. I'm also the chair of the State of Oregon DUII Multidisciplinary Training Task Force. This task force provides training to all disciplines throughout the state in regards to impaired driving. I'm here today in opposition of House Bill 2025. Marijuana is a substance that, by its very nature, impairs a person who is using it. That is why it is a crime to drive under the influence of marijuana, as it is a crime to drive under the influence of any impairing controlled substance. In addition, it is well known that marijuana can become addicting, as is in the case with most impairing substances. Colorado and Washington have seen significant increase in people who are receiving treatment for marijuana dependency since the legalization of marijuana, and Oregon will be no exception. In fact, Measure 91 allocated a large percentage of the proceeds from recreational marijuana sales to go towards treatment. The fact that a person holds a medical marijuana card does not protect them from the potential to abuse marijuana and ultimately the need to seek treatment to address this abuse. Colorado has a similar medical marijuana program and has been active since 2000. From 2001 to 2008, Colorado had about 4,819 medical marijuana cardholders. After medical marijuana centers were opened in 2009, there were 41,039 cardholders, an increase of 751% in just 1 year, according to Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. In November of 2012, recreational marijuana became legal. In December of 2012, there were 108,526 cardholders. By December of 2014, there were 115,467 medical marijuana cardholders in Colorado. Based on an examination of the applications, it was determined that 6% of the cardholders had conditions that warranted the use of marijuana to alleviate the symptoms of debilitating medical conditions such as cancers, seizures, glaucoma, and others. The remaining 94% of the other Colorado participants were found to have not, quote, non-specific pain, end quote, symptoms, and were suspected to be largely recreational marijuana users taking advantage of poor controls. There has been no evidence to suggest that Oregon's numbers would be any different. Both Colorado and Washington have seen a huge increase in marijuana-related DUIs since the legalization of recreational marijuana. By the way of example, DUIs involving marijuana doubled in the city of Denver from 2013 to 2014. There's little doubt that Oregon will also see an increase in the marijuana-related DUIs and therefore an increase in those on diversion. What is most concerning about this bill is that persons can receive a DUI for driving under the influence of marijuana and then continue to use the substance that was the source of the offense. In addition, it says nothing about someone obtaining their card after diversion has begun simply to allow them to continue using marijuana. As others who will testify, this will defeat the purpose of determining whether substance abuse issues the person has is successfully treat the person and to make sure the person does not continue to drive impaired. The safety of the citizens of Oregon depends on this. The passing of this bill will not accomplish our goals of safer highways and decrease the number of crashes and impaired drivers on our roadways. Both the DUII Multidisciplinary Training Task Force and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police ask for you not to pass House Bill 2025. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Rachel Sauray. I am here to represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I am a deputy district attorney out in Washington County, Oregon. I have been working on DUII cases my entire time there for the past 5.5 years and have covered our diversion docket numerous times throughout those years. And I'm echoing what Sergeant Hayes has already said, knowing that marijuana is a drug that impairs, they can be addictive. This is a very concerning bill. People are often addicted to more than one substance, and so we need to make sure that a diversion is able to do its job, whether the DUII that we're dealing with is one that involves marijuana and something else, or something else entirely. We need to make sure that people who are using prescription drugs or other substances while on diversion are able to get treatment properly, are not just substituting another drug to take care of whatever relief they're looking for during that treatment. We need to make sure that evaluators are able to determine how to treat a person successfully. In the situation where somebody has a prescription drug, they are being monitored by a doctor who has made sure that this is a drug the person needs and there's a certain level that they should have. Therefore, a treatment provider is able to limit and look at, is this person within the scope they should be? I understand from speaking to treatment providers that this is a major concern for them with marijuana as they are having to try to figure out what levels can they allow if we are allowing them to use medical marijuana while on diversion. How do we make this fair to everybody else involved in diversion? And just frankly, how can we make sure that treatment is successful? When we can't get to those goals of making sure treatment is successful, diversion is not going to be successful. The purpose of it is to ensure safety, to give people the tools to learn and understand how to make sure that they are acting responsibly when they are using controlled substances or alcohol, and to give them the tools to learn how to handle themselves when they have used those and to not put others at risk in the community. Furthermore, there isn't a prohibition about
receiving medical marijuana card and then using marijuana while on diversion. And certainly, I believe that treatment providers would agree that that's a concern when somebody has shown that they have something they are addicted to, that they would then seek something else to substitute. So I'm asking that this bill not be passed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Troy Costales. I'm the administrator for the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And, Mr. Chair, I'll attempt to add to the earlier testimony and not duplicate things that others have already brought forward. In relationship to House Bill 2025, diversion was a system created by the legislature. It was done in a way that there were controls in place and specific professionals in those areas in order to try and help somebody achieve success and sobriety. 9 out of 10 individuals that impaired drivers that are arrested and go through the process are seen by an evaluator and then are put through treatment. The court supervised agreement is around sobriety and abstinence from intoxicating drugs and alcohol. The individuals under direction by the court, by their doctor if there is prescription, and by the treatment provider. The three areas within this bill in particular that I would raise for you to consider. First, unlike prescriptions, as was mentioned earlier, the medical marijuana program does not require anything in relationship to dosage, potency, frequency, or manner of consumption, like the other items that are mentioned currently as exceptions. Second, the page 2, line 21 of the bill identifies it's not only individuals that have a medical marijuana card, but could have applied for and yet receive a medical marijuana card. Third, there are cannabis-grade prescriptions that are available from physicians for the individual, such as Marinol. And in that particular case, the physician would be granting that authority to the individual where there is dosage, potency, frequency, and manner of consumption spelled out for the treatment provider to be able to follow on behalf of the court. The diversion program established by the legislature is designed to address substance abuse issues and individuals' choice to drive while under the influence of an intoxicating substance. It gives them a chance, without going through the formal court process, to be successful, to be clean, and to be sober. And that this particular bill puts a dent in that particular initiative and what the desires is set forth by the legislature in prior years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Chris and Teresa Douglas, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Teresa Douglas. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUAI, and I'm here testifying on their behalf in opposition to this bill. I'm also an alcohol and drug evaluation specialist and have been working in that capacity for the last 30 years. Well, you've heard the previous testimony, so I don't want to repeat that, but I do want to emphasize that medical marijuana is not a prescription. There is no prescribed dosage. And that is a huge problem for the programs. With prescribed medications, the treatment programs can have communication with the prescribing doctor and can have an ongoing collaboration as to how the medication is supposed to be used. Many treatment programs will monitor how many pills people are taking. They have ways of doing that with the urine testing. So it is able to be monitored, while medical marijuana is not. I can tell you in my years of doing this, I have had a lot of people come through my office that have been on medical marijuana, and a large number of them are telling me that they wanted to continue to use marijuana, so they went and got their card. I had one gentleman a couple years ago that specifically requested a program clear across town from where he lived because they did groups on Wednesday night. That was the only night he didn't play soccer. And he traveled by bicycle. And so I asked him why he was using medical marijuana, and he told me it was for back pain. So I would ask on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUAI that you not pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Wigg, and I work for Emergence Addiction and Behavioral Therapies in Eugene, Oregon. I serve as the primary care coordinator there, and I'm here to testify for Emergence and OPRA, the Oregon Prevention, Education, and Recovery Association. I'd like to echo the things that my colleagues from the governor's office, prosecutor, police, and transportation have said. I think that they've outlined the case pretty well. In my capacity, I work with the Lane County Drug Court, and so the clients that I see have been somewhat mandated, but they've agreed to come into our drug court like a diversion program. They've agreed to come in and participate in the system and work within the rules. When a client comes in, they use a wide variety of both legal and illegal intoxicating drugs, and we test them. We test all of them for all of the drugs via urinalysis. When the client tests positive for a drug of potential abuse, we immediately contact his or her physician of care and gather information about what is the dosage and administration instructions for the prescription, what symptoms the medication prescribed to alleviate, and is it appropriate for the client to take that medication after being arrested for DUII or unlawful possession of a controlled substance. We compile the information, we present it to our clinical team, and then our clinical team works with the physician of care for the client in order to determine whether or not it's appropriate for that client to take that medication if they're in treatment for a DUII. It's been said here before, but most of the prescribers in the OMMP program are not the primary physician of care for the client, and so it would be very hard to work with them to monitor the dosage and to see if that is an appropriate medication if the only time they've seen that client is when they wrote them their green card. And so I thank the committee for hearing us out and listening to this testimony today, and I really appreciate the chance to come out.
Thank you very much and appreciate your testimony. Okay. Thank you.
Chair Barker, I'd love to make a comment before we close the public hearing.
Okay,
on this.
Please.
Is this time? So I appreciate the testimony from the people who've come to express concern about allowing medical marijuana use during diversion program and the people who explain why it would make sense. I think that the problem is that we're in this transition period where, you know, the legislature has created the diversion program, but the legislature also, some number of years ago, created the medical marijuana program that's premised on the idea the medical marijuana program is premised on the idea that marijuana can be used as a medicine. And so we, I think, are going to need to figure out where we stand on this issue. And, you know, people are offering a bright line today in their positions on this bill, and this bill may not be the right vehicle to resolve the issue, but I think we do need to deal with the conflict between, you know, one strain in our culture and our community saying marijuana is a medical product, and the diversion programs that enable medical products to be used but not other products. So it's not an easy and open and shut answer, but I do think it's something we're going to have to grapple with.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2025. And open a hearing on House Bill 31, public hearing 3170. Representative Benz, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 3170 comes to us from our own Representative Olson as well as Representative Benz. The bill allows law enforcement to ask for a blood draw in a driving under the influence of intoxicants investigation pursuant to Oregon's implied consent law. There are no amendments before us today, and we do not yet have the paperwork on this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cliff Benz, District 60. Thank you for hearing this bill. It presents an interesting issue of whether we should expand the implied consent law to include blood draws. The issue was brought to me by a constituent because of Malheur County being immediately adjacent to Idaho and the anticipation of people perhaps crossing the river to enjoy Oregon's new recreational marijuana opportunities. It appears likely that this will happen since you can hardly find a place to rent in Malheur County now that isn't already taken up in anticipation of large grows of marijuana. And I'm not exaggerating. The question becomes, how does law enforcement meet this challenge and with what tools? I was just reviewing an article in the ABA Journal about this issue, which I recommend. They do a wonderful job of talking about this issue, April 1st of 2014. And it appears, because of McNeely and other cases, that the choice in many states comes down to whether we'll simply see if people are under the influence. And I know you guys are dealing with this all the time, but I think the descriptive phrase is zero tolerance, or blood test, or not. And so the purpose of this bill is to bring this issue before you and to ask for help in arming our police with appropriate tools to meet the challenge that is just about upon us.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, state representative from the Albany area. And I, you know, basically this, and you have one of the committee members, Representative Leininger, she happens to be co-chair on the Joint Committee for Measure 91. We've listened to a lot of testimony over the last several weeks. But one of the things that is becoming clear, I mean, come July 1st, we're going to have both medical marijuana and we're also going to have recreational use for marijuana here in cannabis in the state. To spin off a little bit of what Representative Bench just said, law enforcement is going to need to have a tool. And the tool that I believe makes sense is what lies in House Bill 3170. And that's to add blood also to the portion of testing when it comes to driving under the influence of intoxicants, especially as it applies now toward what's happening with the presence of cannabis in systems. There's a couple different ways that the implied consent law works, and I think actually Sergeant Hayes, you're going to probably share a little bit more in depth on that. But, but one of the things that I really wanted to kind of share with you, Oregon is one of the very few states left that still use urine through their process of the drug recognition expert in identifying what type of substance a person has. The majority of the states are using blood right now. Why is that important? Well, how long does cannabis stay in the system? See, that's the thing. Urine will reflect that up to potentially 30 days. But blood is the item that will actually identify the volume of what's present in a person's system. And that's where it becomes very useful as a tool, and it also kind of as a defense mechanism for the individual who's the driver, be truthful with you. But that's where we're wanting to go. That's why I'm very supportive of this with Representative Bentz to move forward with 3170.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Hayes. I'm a patrol sergeant with Albany Police Department. I'll skip my credentials since I said it on the last testimony.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3170, which would expand the administration license suspension and impose a fine for refusing to provide a blood test and driver's DUIs involving controlled substances. For a typical DUI investigation, an officer is going to, there's three phases. There's a vehicle in motion. The officer is going to see the vehicle and stop it. They're going to make that observation. They're going to then go into phase two, which is personal contact. That's when we go up and contact the driver and we ask him for their driver's license, registration, proof of insurance, and talk to him about the reason for the stop. During that time, the officer is going to make observations and see if they see observations of appearance, i.e. watery, bloodshot eyes, odor coming from the vehicle, slurred speech. After that is phase three, which is pre-arrest screening. We're going to have them come out of the car, consent. If they say no, then obviously we'll have them come out of the car if we believe probable cause exists for DUII. And then we'll see if they'll consent to a battery of field sobriety test, the horizontal gaze and nystagmus test, which is the eye test. We'll have them do the walk and turn, and then the one leg stand. And there's other tests that we could use, but those three will be done. After that, the officer is going to make a determination. At this point, we don't know if it's just alcohol, if there's drugs, or if anything else is on board. We're just making an arrest solely on impairment of that individual. Then a person is then going to be transported to the facility, jail, police department, where they're going to be read the implied consent form, advised of the rights and consequences, and then either they'll submit or not submit to a breath test. If they submit to a breath test and that BAC is under a 0.08, then they're going to either end the investigation if they don't believe they have reasonable suspicion that a drug is involved. But if they believe a drug's involved, then they're going to call a drug recognition expert. The drug recognition expert's going to come do a 12-step process. And at the end of that process, we're going to collect a urine sample. If they refuse to give a urine sample, then we're going to do a suspension through implied consent. That suspension is going to cost be with a $650 fine for refusing. And depending if they've had a prior DUI, if they haven't, it's going to be a one-year suspension on their driver's license. If they've had a prior, then it's going to be a three-year suspension on their driver's license. So that's the process. This is not changing the process. We're adding to it. We're adding a tool of taking blood. Urine, as Representative Olson stated, urine tells us the substance is in the body, but it doesn't say it's being psychoactive at that time. If we collect blood and we find that drug in the blood, then the crime lab can come testify in regards to it being psychoactive in the body. The crime lab right now does test blood, but they only test blood for alcohol. If an agency wants to test blood, let's say in a manslaughter investigation or something for a DUI, they have to send it off and pay for another company, usually Fortis Labs up in Wilsonville or another department, to do the testing. So this bill doesn't change the process. The lab will be able to hopefully test these items for the drugs, and we're going to see an increase in impaired drivers. As I stated in my last testimony with the legalization of marijuana, we're going to see an increase. Officers are not going to be pulling people out on the side of the road collecting blood samples. There will be processes implemented in collecting those samples like they have now. Agencies take people to the hospital to collect those samples, or they take people, like Portland has AMR, the ambulance service, come and collect the samples. So we're not doing collecting samples on roadside. And also, not just marijuana, but it can affect other drug categories, such as narcotic analgesics, opiates, heroin, oxycodone. People who take these drugs, it can dehydrate the body. If the body is dehydrated, sometimes they cannot produce a urine sample. This will give us another avenue to collect a sample from the person, because if we can't collect that sample, then it's going to be registered as a refusal. They'll say, hey, take my blood, and we'll be able to take the blood from them. We will need, from the legalization of marijuana, all officers are going to be trained in drugs that impair driving, but we're going to need more training on the road in regards to officers, as in regards to advanced roadside impaired driving enforcement and more DREs. So in closing, the DUI Multidisciplinary Training Task Force and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police asked for the committee to pass 3170, and I can answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a recognized level, the equivalent of 0.08 in alcohol in the blood for things like marijuana or OxyContin?
Washington and Colorado do have a recognized level. However, there is discrepancies in that level that I believe. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Greenlake.
No, I wish you'd continue. Yes.
Okay. They have 5 nanograms, but that study was done with people who were involved in motor vehicle crashes and were deceased. So there was no range on how it's dissipating, per se, from the individual. What Washington, and I've talked to Sergeant Mark Crandall, the state coordinator for the Washington State Patrol, what they're finding is they're having people who are arrested for DUII, by the time they get the blood sample, they're down to 1 to 2 nanograms. So they're underneath that cutoff level because it's going out of the blood fairly quickly. They had a guy who was arrested, and he told the officer, I am high as a kite. And by the time they got the blood sample, he was 2.5 nanograms in the blood. So there are states that do have cutoff levels, but I think they need to be lower.
Mr. Chairman, I follow.
Please.
So what are you going to make of this when you get it, as to the extent to which the person is impaired or not impaired? I mean, if you have it determined without the blood, that's one thing. But now you get the blood, it's questionable. You get the blood. How do you know what to make of the blood test, depending on its 1 nanogram, say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, yeah, that's a great question to ask. The thing is that... before you even get to this point, the officer, as Sergeant Hayes started out testifying, is we've already developed probable cause to arrest the individual. And we've determined at that initial point that the officer believes that this individual is impaired to some perceptible degree. Now, whether that initially, you're suspecting maybe alcohol because you smell that, but it might be going down the circumstances, too, as you then determine what the level of alcohol is as a result of the breath test. If it's below the 0.08 level, then, I mean, we then, police officers, I can't say we, I'm out of that now. they then move forward with further evaluation to determine exactly, is this a combination of things that this individual has inside their system? And if it is, the DRE is going to be able to determine that. But that's the process. And, you know, to your other question, the 5 nanograms that Washington State has determined to be the right level, I'm not interested in doing that here in the state. I'm interested in plugging in the blood piece into the implied consent side to help as a tool, because when you arrest somebody, you're going to determine through the process whether or not they're being affected to a perceptible degree.
Representative Krieger?
Anyone there, I would suspect, and I've heard it's happened in Washington, that a high percentage of people have both alcohol and drug. So you do the, you get a point 10, 10. Are you going to stop there, or do you think then that you have to go to something else if he for instance, admits that he's had marijuana?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, if they're a 0.08 or higher, the investigation is over through implied consent. Okay. We don't continue through for urine or blood through implied consent. That's the only time it's over. The only time we extend that is if it's a crash and they're at the hospital, and obviously we can't get the results of that breath test at that time. If we have reasonable suspicion that controlled substance is on board, then we can collect it. So there would be no continued investigation if they're a 0.10. It would be done.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm looking right now at some meeting materials, including a letter from the ACLU in opposition to the bill. And I'm wondering how you respond to the point that they make in the letter that I guess typically a warrant is required to do an inside-the-body search for evidence, and that since and so as a result, based on Supreme Court decision, and as a result of the fact that it's such an intrusive procedure, that it's just not a valid way to waive that right to be free of unreasonable search and seizure, to have an implied consent.
Chair Barker, Representative Linger. So for to do the search, an officer needs to either have consent, exigency, mm-hmm. probable cause, and if that, or a warrant. Evasive is a word that naturally comes up. I see this as better, because if a person refuses and we have to submit a warrant for a blood sample, I would rather someone to take a blood sample than someone to refuse a urine test. Because if someone refuses a urine test, we submit a warrant, the way to collect that urine is going to be through catheterization. I think a blood draw would be less evasive than that.
But it sounds like under the scenario you're describing, there's a warrant issued, and the thing that is happening under this bill is that there's not a warrant, there's implied consent for that physical invasion.
Correct. So if they consent to it, then we collect the sample. If they don't, and they, let's say they refuse field sobriety test and they refuse to give us a blood or urine test, then officers would apply, hopefully, for a search warrant to collect their evidence of driving under the influence of intoxicants. Sure.
Thank you.
Search warrant's different than a subpoena, though.
Mm-hmm. Ina Ryerson, Troy Costales, and Rachel Sowery again, please.
Members of the committee, my name is Dina Ryerson. I work at Department of Justice, and I'm the state DUI resource prosecutor. And happy birthday, Chair Barker. Just to clarify something, I don't want to reiterate the testimony, but just to clarify some comments that were made and some questions that were asked. As Sergeant Hayes has testified, the process Let me be clear what the bill, House Bill 3170, does. It does not add blood to the process. That is something that currently can be done under Oregon law right now. The reason why it's not done is because the Oregon State Police Crime Lab does not have the resources, the manpower, or womanpower, obviously, or the instrumentation to add blood testing for controlled substances into the system and into the process at this point. So currently today, as it stands now, a police officer can get a warrant and get a blood sample from a person who is suspected of DUI. Does it happen on a regular basis? No, it doesn't for that reason. If they did collect the blood sample, it would have to be sent out to a private lab. It costs money to have the blood tested, and then it would have to go if there is a trial, it's I think a couple thousand dollars for testimony. So that's why that doesn't happen. What House Bill 3170 does is, if it comes to a point where hopefully the resources are there for the crime lab to be the place to test for blood, House Bill 3170 simply makes a license suspension, just as breath or urine, for a person who refuses to provide a blood sample, and gives the deterrent effect that accompanies breath samples. For example, if someone's deciding if they want to drink alcohol and get in a car and drive, most of the public knows if I get caught, my license is going to be suspended if I refuse to give a breath sample. So it'd be the same thing for blood, and that's what 3170 does. The problem has been discussed with urine, and the problem has been a problem that's been for some time, and it's something that's been in discussion for some time. There was a work group for the last maybe year and a half that Representative Thompson, who used to be a representative, put together a DUI work group that involved defense attorneys, prosecutors, treatment providers, ADISs, we had ODOT, DMV, and part of that work group discussed switching to have blood be the sample for detecting controlled substances. It was interesting because that was one good time where the defense and the prosecution were all in agreement that we need to start using blood as the sample to detect for controlled substances. Because it was in benefit to both the offender as well as to the prosecution, depending on what the set of facts is were for the case. So, for example, right now the prosecution says, okay, we saw all these signs of impairment. The controlled substance was in your urine, and so this is the evidence we're putting for in front of you, jury. And the defense will come say, well, it's in my urine, but just because it's in my urine doesn't mean I'm impaired by it, because that's not active in my system at the time. So that's where it stands now. And that's why the defense, and I don't want to speak for the defense bar, but that's why they're saying we want better evidence, because we don't want our clients being convicted if, you know, this evidence shows it's in my urine, but that's not what's actively impairing me at the time. So it cuts both ways. And that's why the discussions were centered around wanting this sample to switch to blood and not urine, and the problems with urine. Now, with the onset of legalized marijuana, recreational marijuana, and I can give you all the statistics, or several statistics, if you want, of the increase of DUIs in Colorado and Washington. As Sergeant Hayes said, in Denver alone, there was a 50% increase in 1 year in marijuana-related DUIs. In Washington, in 2012, they had 18% of their drug DUIs were marijuana-related. In 2013, it went up to 25% were marijuana-related, and in talking to my counterpart in Washington, in 2014, it's going to be even a higher percentage of their drug DUIs related to marijuana. So the question that's brought forward with this bill is, will the legislature give the resources to the Oregon State Police Crime Lab? And then the point of the bill is to tie the implied consent to a refusal of blood. And that's all this bill does, is tying implied consent to a refusal of blood. And to answer Representative Greenlick's question about a level equating to impairment for marijuana, the studies and all the experts in the country, Barry Logan, talk about the fact that, and this cuts both ways, A level does not equate to impairment because it depends on dose, it depends on frequency of use. There can be very small amounts of marijuana, the active ingredient of marijuana in the blood, and the person may not be impaired. And on the alternative, you can have levels of marijuana in the blood and be impaired. But everyone will agree that having amounts in the blood will be a better indicator of active impairment of marijuana. And as Sergeant Hayes was saying, the 5 nanograms is not based in science, and most people are starting to understand that and agree with that.
Well, you argue that it cuts both ways, but the .08, a defendant is interested in taking it because he blows a .02 and he says, see, I'm not impaired, because you have a strong argument because the .08 is what's generally considered impaired. Seems to me with marijuana in the blood, you're arguing, well, it'll always be introduced anyway, whatever the level is. And there's no way, I mean, you can argue that he failed a field sobriety test and he's 2 nanograms, so obviously he's impaired, right? And you can say, well, but it's only 2, and therefore I'm not impaired. Without a standard, it seems to me all it adds is confusion rather than light.
Well, Representative Barker and Representative Greenlick, I understand that's a great observation to make. However, it's impossible to correlate alcohol with marijuana as far as setting a presumptive level of impairment with the nature of the way marijuana leaves the system. It leaves the system in half-lives. But what the difference between the presence in the urine versus the presence in the blood is that the presence in the blood means it's an active metabolite in the blood, and you're actually detecting the active metabolite. And so then it's a matter of, like you said, it's a matter of the defense can make their arguments, and then the state can make their arguments, but at least you're dealing with evidence that talks about active impairment and active metabolites. And so, and then both sides get to argue their case, and then the jury decides, and that's what's the great part about our system. And so there is no science that supports a one level, and that's because the process, and I know we're going too long, so I'm going to try and wrap it up, the process in which law enforcement collects blood is extended. By way of example, the case that Sergeant Hayes was talking about, a person was arrested for DUI. The officer came up to the window. He failed to go through a light. He was sitting at the light. There was a bong sitting in his lap. The officer asked for the bong. The gentleman, he asked him to do field sobriety test. He says, I'm high as a kite. I'm so, you know, messed up, and this, I can give you the report if you'd like. They went through the process that Sergeant Hayes described. They got a warrant, got his blood in 2 hours and 17 minutes after the time of the stop, and he admittedly said, you know, I'm high, I just smoked marijuana. And his nanogram level was 2.5, and that was going through the legal process. And so that legal process, to put a number, injures the ability to get the evidence that way, if that makes sense. And to set a number. So that being said, I just wanted to clarify in my testimony what this bill does and what it doesn't do, and leave it at that. So
I want to make sure I understand what this bill does. This essentially makes a blood draw with implied consent the same as urine collection or a breathalyzer.
The refusal of, yes. So there's no level it's different than breath, because in breath, if you blow a .8 or higher.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the way that you are able to access that process. Because as I understand it, the U.S. Supreme Court has said blood draws are not like other kinds of data collection, whether it's urine or breathalyzer. So I'm a little concerned about grouping them together as though they're all the same thing, when there is a legal distinction between whether somebody thinks getting a blood drawn or a catheter, whichever one is worse, it doesn't matter, because the Supreme Court thinks getting a blood draw is worse. So I'm just trying to make sure
it's more protective.
Well, but more intrusive, yeah. I guess I would say. A blood draw is more intrusive. So I just want to make sure I really understand legally what we're doing.
Well, I believe you're referring to Missouri versus McNeely. And as you stated, the Supreme Court discussed the intrusiveness of blood. However, what they did do was they said they endorsed implied consent. They continue, and I have the opinion here if you'd like to look at it. They endorsed implied consent in that opinion. They also said that in some cases you can get a blood sample without a warrant if you have exigency, and that's going to be a case-by-case basis. So it doesn't change the nature of how we proceed with the law. As long as you have consent, you have probable cause and exigency, or you have a warrant, you're still able to get the sample. Obviously, we can't force someone to do a breath test or anything. I mean, we're not talking about force at all, but the blood sample simply says if you refuse, this bill says if you refuse a blood sample, you get a license suspension, just as in. So I guess I'm. That's what Missouri versus McNeely holds. So, this bill would just provide deterrence for people to not drive impaired by any controlled substance.
Thank you,
Chair Barker. Okay, so I just want to make sure I'm probably going to ask fairly close to the same question. I want to restate maybe what you said to make sure I'm understanding this. This bill is not adding blood test, it's adding the refusal of a blood test. Is
Representative
that correct?
Barker, Representative Post, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. I think I'm going to move my hands up. Well, I'm just thinking,
Thank you very much, panel. I'm going to take a break in this bill at this time. We have a major bill that we need to be sure people have adequate time on. So this time I'm closing the public hearing on 3170. We're not through with it. People who I know the opposition wanted to test people. There were people who were opposed. You'll have time to testify, but maybe not today. And I'm going to open a hearing now on House Bill 2317.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2317, as introduced, technically extends the statute of limitations from 10 years to 12 years for an action of recovery of real property or for recovery of possession of real property. We, however, have three amendments before us which all replace the bill. The -1 amendments provide that prosecution for the crimes of rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, and sexual abuse in the first degree may be commenced at any time after the commission of the offense. It prescribes that the bill applies to offenses committed on or after the act, but that the act does not operate to revive previously barred prosecutions. The -2 amendments provide that the prosecution may be commenced within 20 years after the commission of the same set of offenses. They specify that if a victim was a minor at the time of the offense, prosecution may be commenced either within 20 years or before the victim attains age 30, whichever occurs later. And finally, the -3 amendments provide that prosecution may be commenced within 12 years after the commission of the same set of offenses. They specify that if a victim was a minor at the time of the offense, prosecution may be commenced either within 12 years or before the victim attains age 30.
Thank you.
Whichever is later.
Whichever occurs later is only for -2, not for the -3.
Not for -3. Mm-hmm.
Danielle Tudor and Hazel Flores and Jenny Went Ewing, please. Please go in any order. Remember to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, and Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Tudor, and I am here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2317. I am also representing the interests of Crime Victims United, and I have also been asked to represent the interests of the Oregon District Attorneys Association today.
And it's important to note that I have either met with or had conversations with the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, the National Crime Victims Law Institute, and the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force, who are all in favor of this bill as well. And I also have traveled around our state. I have spoken to agencies all over our state that deal with sexual assault victims, and they are there to help them through crisis. I've met with them, spoken to their staff. I've met with survivors all over our state and agencies actually all around the country. So I feel like I have a pretty good understanding today as far as what I'm asking with House Bill 2317. And Chair Barker, I would like to thank you for, I guess I believed I was naive enough and bold enough to call you and make an appointment with you on February 2nd and ask you for this bill. And looking back now, we are only 2 months from that meeting. And I want other survivors to know that when you have a piece of legislation that makes sense, that it's worth it to contact a legislator and to try and get a bill on that. And I thank you for what you did and for agreeing to do that, and that's why I'm here today. Unfortunately, what this bill is deciding is if there's a statute of limitations on justice for rape victims. Personally, as a survivor of rape, I was a victim of Richard Gilmore, Oregon or Portland's jogger rapist, in 1979. I was not the only victim. There were at least 9 of us that we know of, and I believe there are more that never reported it. But there were 8 of us that never received justice. And with the way that the statute of limitations stands today, there are still 8 of us who would still not see justice. And 35 years down the road from the time of my rape, our laws have not changed enough that I would see justice today. To me, that's a very archaic law that needs to change. And we've got several options here. We've added a 12-year option, we've got a 20-year option, and we've got a no statute of limitations option. And I was fortunate enough to be here in 2009 to sit before this same committee when we did away with the statute of limitations on rape with DNA evidence. I'm very proud of that bill, and I'm very honored that I got to be a part of that with other victims of Richard Gilmore. However, what I didn't realize at that time is that that bill would not cover my rape. And the reason that that is because Richard Gilmore was canny enough and smart enough, one, not to leave DNA evidence with the majority of his rape victims. So that takes the DNA off the table. The second one is he was also very intelligent and was able to hide from law enforcement till it passed the statute of limitations. And that is still true today. If we had another Richard Gilmore serial rapist and it happened exactly the way that it did during my time in my case and his other victims, we still have the majority of victims that would be left out of the justice process. And from my perspective, that's wrong. And I hope from your perspective that that's wrong as well. I know there will be those here today who will speak in opposition of this bill. And one of the things I can tell you is that unless you've been a victim of sexual assault, of rape, and statistics, we've got an epidemic with sexual assault. Statistically, 1 in 3 women in their lifetime will be a victim of some type of sexual assault. That's horrendous. That should not be acceptable to us. And only 3% of rapists ever spend a day in prison? Something is out of kilter. Something is out of whack here. And I think the statute of limitations is part of that. If the statute of limitations had worked for me, law enforcement did everything they could. The DA did everything they could. It was the statute of limitations that failed me, and it still does today. And I don't think that should be acceptable for anyone or to anyone in this room. I don't care if you're part of the defense bar, a district attorney, doesn't matter who you are, just a common citizen. That should not be acceptable from anyone's perspective. And if we're worried about public safety, you know, there's this theory that rape is like a one-hour episode of Law and Order SVU, that in an hour's program, you have a rape victim, you have the perpetrator caught, you go to court, and then that person is sentenced to prison. Done. And real life is not like that. It is very complicated. There is no crime. There's no perfect crime. There's no perfect victim. And every single rape is different for each person that experiences it. So you can't put this package deal together that we're going to handle rape with every single victim the same. It's not possible. Some need more time. I recently had a conversation with a district attorney, and that attorney told me, he said, you know, having worked with you girls on the Gilmore case and seeing what it did to your lives and how it affected you, it has really given me pause in how I move forward with prosecution with other rape victims. And he saw the gamut in our case. And mind you, most of us went to trial 7 to 9 years after our rape, because it took them 7 years to actually catch Gilmore from my rape in 1979. Now, mind you, I got a phone call from detectives in December of 1986, 7 years later, and they told me they had a suspect in my case, and that composite sketch that I gave police the night of my rape is what caught him. But there's just one problem. The statute of limitations has passed in your case, and you will never see justice. You know the only justice that I actually get, that I actually see, is going to a parole hearing every 2 years to face my perpetrator every 2 years before the parole board to relive that night in detail. And I will do that as many times as I have to keep him in prison, because prison was made for people like Richard Gilmore. But unfortunately, because the statute of limitations failed me and 7 other women, there is a day that he will get out. There is a day. And that should never be. That should never have been. And he should have been held responsible for all of his rapes. So when you're looking at DNA evidence, and then we're looking at a statute without DNA, you have to remember, we have very smart criminals who are capable of hiding from law enforcement. In fact, my rapist flaunted that to law enforcement when he was caught. He flaunted the fact that he was able to hide from them, that he was smarter than them, and they didn't catch him. And that should not be. That should not be possible in today's day and time. When we went to trial 7 to 9 years later, for most of his victims, he was only prosecuted for one rape, and that was the rape of a 13-year-old girl named Tiffany Edens. But the rest of us had to go through that process. We all had to go to court. We all had to be torn apart by the defense attorney, even though our rapist had confessed to all of our rapes. we still had to go through that process. And, you know, we had victims that had gotten into drugs, to alcohol, depression, PTSD, afraid to be home alone at night. And we had one that committed suicide. And I know there's the philosophy that justice needs to be swift. It needs to be fast. We need to get that person off the street so he doesn't harm anyone else. You know what? That sounds great. It does. I wish it operated like that. I do. But it doesn't. Sometimes it takes time. It takes law enforcement time to catch people like Gilmore. We need to allow for that time. We're casting that net with that time frame going out, giving law enforcement people who deserve justice more time. And like I said, if it was up to me, I would say no statute of limitations. It means that much to me. I'm that passionate about it. And we reached out to the Defense Attorneys Association. We met with them for 3 hours trying to find common ground, and we could not. In 3 hours, we came away with, we agree to disagree. And as a survivor of rape that never got justice, it was insulting to me to hear them say we need to stay at 6 years, because 6 years still locks me out of the justice system. And it's insulting as a survivor to hear somebody say you still deserve to be locked out of that justice system, because that's what it says to me, and that's what it says to the other victims of Richard Gilmore who never got justice. And that's not fair, and it's not right. And every victim of sexual assault, and mind you, we're talking the most heinous crimes here. We're not talking just any sex crime. We're talking the most heinous ones, the ones we do need to be the most concerned about. So I'd like to ask representatives if you would please, this bill needs to go from this committee. It needs to move on. And I ask you to go for longer options, for 20 years or no statute of limitations at all. I know we're afraid that there's going to be he said, she said cases that come up. You know, the burden of proof is still always going to be on prosecution. And we're not, by promoting this legislation, asking victims not to report. Quite to the contrary, we're asking them to report. Anytime I speak publicly, it's part of my platform. Please report. Please do the rape kit. Please do everything in your power to be able to get justice down the road, however far down the road that is. So we're not asking victims to just, you know, not take any responsibility, not do anything, and come back 15, 18, 20 years later and go, oh, by the way, I want to prosecute now for rape. That's not what we're after. That's not what this bill is about. It's not about that at all. And I ask this committee, please, please. And thank you for listening to me today. Thank you for letting me be here. And please, if you have any questions at all, please ask me. I can handle it. I am happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you, please.
Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Olson and Wilson, and members of the committee. My name is Hazel Flores, and I'm also here to show my support for House Bill 2317. I would like to thank the committee for allowing me to speak here. I am an undergraduate at Reed College and at Sarah Lawrence College at one point, and I have conducted literature research on the biological elements of trauma, as well as working for Raphael House for translation services and dealing with traumatizing and dangerous situations in that regard. Based on the research I encountered in the last few years, I believe that the underlying issues of trauma are due in part to biological changes. That is, that your brain functions differently after an event, after rape, after you have been traumatized. And when I say traumatized, I mean either PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or elements of PTSD that don't necessarily fit that category, but certainly are fitting for other forms of trauma. PTSD is the most common form of the long-lasting trauma and is defined as exposure to an event threatening harm or violence or death even to a person. The most common symptoms that you probably have heard about or seen are flashbacks, nightmares. Other people encounter emotional numbing. That is to say, instead of getting hysterical, they get quiet. Trauma depends on the person. It does affect people differently. However, there are some common underlying issues that do change for all trauma people. For one, memory encoding works differently in instances of PTSD because connections between the systems within your brain are different. Your entire biology is rewired, basically. So the limbic system and the HPA axis are both very important in terms of encoding your memory, in terms of dealing with your fear and other emotions. And when you are traumatized, these structures can change. So one of the structures, for example, is the hippocampus. And that actually shrinks in a lot of survivors and a lot of people who are traumatized. So there is evidence for actual biological changes. So what does this mean? Well, these biological changes means that trauma or victims of trauma are usually in a hyper-aroused state, which means that they're very quick to see stimuli as dangerous. And when they interpret these stimuli, even if these stimuli are not actually dangerous, their brain functions, they biologically react as though they are encountering the trauma once again. So it's almost as if they are encountering multiple traumas by having to look at these issues. So in regards to having to report within a certain amount of time, if an individual is at this point of being traumatized, having them report, having them go through the system is actually making them go through the trauma again. And that's potentially very, very dangerous for them. In fact, one of the first things that therapists will try to do to help traumatized victims is to regain control. And that is one of the things that victims often lose in rape cases and sexual assault cases. And the way they do this is by allowing the individual to report, to talk, to do what they need to do in order to feel safe. And by limiting the statute of limitations to 6 years, we're saying you need to get healed in 6 years, and that's not a realistic possibility for a lot of these traumatized individuals. In fact, in your brain, you are cognitively impaired as well when you go through trauma. That is to say that the right cerebral hemisphere, which is involved in actual speaking and forming your verbal connections, has delays. So the idea or the comment, "I can't explain it," is actually supported by this. And PTSD doesn't have a time frame. Some people take years. Some people take months. It depends. It waxes and wanes as well. Sometimes it goes away for a little bit. You get better for a couple of months. It dies down. Maybe you're not exposed to the stimuli as much. And then it can reappear. And in something as violating as rape, we need to minimize the re-experience in order to limit its intensity and its duration and help the people get over it as soon as possible. We can help individuals find control in these crimes in a non-intrusive way by extending the statute of limitations. And not only does this help the individual and guarantee their safety, but it also guarantees the safety of the community. So I'd like to say thank you again for letting me speak, and I will answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Hi. I'd like to... Excuse me. Thank you for having me. My name is Jenny Wendt Ewing. I would like to give you a short summary of my story. I am from Indiana. I was attacked by someone that worked for my college, my university. It was a very violent attack. I was injured very badly. I was raped and sodomized and then stalked afterwards. I was unable to report it. I did not have any DNA evidence to prove it was him. I was very terrified of the man. So I had no choice in my mind. I had nothing to do. If I could go back, I would report it. But that's what I chose to do at the time. Fast forward. He confesses January 2014. Walks out a free man. There's nothing we can do. It's 9 years later. There's a 5-year statute of limitations in Indiana. If it were happened in here in Oregon, it would have been the same scenario. The reason I'm here today is because I support to change the statute of limitations here in Oregon. I started a campaign in Indiana when this happened to me. I was able to pass a law called Jenny's Law with the help of a very wonderful senator called Mike Kreider. He was my main backer. Writer of this bill, and there were many sponsors and authors, co-authors and sponsors on this. As of yesterday, it's passed on to the governor. We're just waiting for it to be signed. It's passed through unanimously through each leg. What it does is it adds a new 5-year window. If anybody decides to confess to their crime, if they find any video or audio evidence that will stand up in court, or if they find any DNA evidence. Now, would I have liked to have seen more? Of course. But I'm happy to have gotten some change made, which is another goal of ours here today, why we are all here today. Which brings me to another thing. I would like to give you a few reasons why we should all be in support of a change of a statute of limitations. Number one being everybody in this room knows someone who has been raped. You just may not know it yet. 1 in 3. We could rattle off all the statistics we have heard, all of us, a million times. But we don't need to do that. Whenever someone is asked for an example, they're usually asked for what? 3. How many are in here? 1, 2, 3, right now, today. One from 1978, one from 1998, one from 2005. Spans over 3 decades. That right there should tell you that there is indeed an epidemic. So, can you imagine from all the work all of us have done, our advocacy, awareness, the people we have spoken to and worked with, the stories that we have heard, both familiar and strangers that have come to us. It's unreal. If you were to sit here and talk to us, we could probably talk to you for hours, days, weeks about the different stories we've heard. The epidemic is unreal in this country. Over 20 states or more have no statute of limitations. That also tells you something. And then if you look at all the people and the support, the media, the craze, the buzz that is talked about across the United States, not just here in Oregon, every state right now, in the past couple years, there is a need for change. There's a reason why there is such a buzz in the feet, a buzz in the media right now about rape, sexual assault. It's all over TV, the media. It's in everybody's changing laws right now. If you look at the legislature in every state, they probably have bills up regarding sexual assault and rape right now. This year, last year, next year, it's probably going to be happening for years to come, which brings me to another idea or point I would like to make. I support at least 20 years, if not elimination at all, because what's going to happen is you're going to make a change and then probably in the future going to have to change it again, and it's just going to cause more money. Indiana made a change a year ago in part of their sexual assault laws, and that was part of their reasoning for not wanting to make the statute of limitations to have no limit at all. Because they had already, we'd spent so much money already, we can't spend a little bit more. So if you know you're already headed in that direction and more than almost half of the United States is there, why not make the jump and set an example for the rest of the United States? And we're already going there anyway. Now, 2 other things. People are worried about memory, time, when it comes to statute of limitations. Think of an Alzheimer's patient. Even though their memory is starting to fade, they still have their long-term memory. It's still there. Your memory bank is always there. It might get a little bit fuzzy, but it's always there in your brain, which leads me to my next point. So when you think of memories, think of being a child, something favorite your mom cooked. Think of that smell or a song. You might hear a song. What does it do? Your memory comes back just like that in a snap. So think about being assaulted or raped. You don't think that a smell, the smell that man had, his breath, or maybe a song or a noise that you were hearing at the time it happened. You bet you'll remember everything as soon as you smell or hear or think of that. Or reliving it like she was talking about, these two ladies here, when you relive it over and over, that memory is not going to fade because it's happening over and over to you. Then I'll take you one last time. I'm going to ask everybody in this room to do one thing, and then I'll shut up. If you could please just close your eyes for me for 1 second, maybe five, and then think of the women and men that you know and all of our situations that we've described. I know you haven't heard from Brenda, but you know hers. And think how easily that could happen to one of them. Thank you so much. Any questions?
Any questions for this? Thank you very much for your testimony. Really appreciate you coming in and doing this once again and reliving this. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Brenda Tracy, Stephen Crew, and Jacqueline Swanson.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Crew. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon. I represent Brenda Tracy, who's sitting next to me. And next to Brenda is another lawyer from my office, Jackie Swanson. We're going to start with Brenda. I'd like you to hear her story, and then I have a few remarks about that, and Jackie will conclude those remarks. Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tracy. Sorry, take a deep breath before I get started. In 1998, I was the victim of a gang rape by four men. Two of them were Oregon State football players. And I was drugged, and the entire event, I think, probably lasted about 7 hours. I was raped and sodomized repeatedly. Other objects were also used on me during the crime. I don't know everything that happened to me, thank God. But I do remember enough. There was enough times that I came in and out of consciousness to have moments of horrible... I don't know, memories, such as the girl that was sitting here before me said, and it kind of re-traumatizes you every time because it kind of takes you back to that moment. After the attack, when I was fully awake, I was laying face down in the middle of the floor of the apartment. I had a small throw blanket kind of haphazardly thrown across me, and I had vomited at one point while they were raping me. So when I woke up, I had old vomit in my hair. I had a piece of gum stuck in my hair that I had to cut out later. And there were bits of chips and food stuck to the front of me, including a used condom. And I had never felt more disgusting than that moment. I truly felt like a piece of garbage. My best friend was with me at that apartment that night. She was in the next room. And when I woke that morning and found my clothes, I went and I asked her to take me home. And on the way home, she said to me, I think that, she said, Brenda, it's going to be okay. You just got a little in over your head last night. And being her best friend, I knew that she knew what had happened to me and that she did not intervene or try to help me. So our friendship Our friendship ended at that moment. I went home. My mom came to my side. And we went to the Women's Crisis Center. And they said to me, at the time I said I didn't know if I wanted to report. I was scared. I didn't fully understand what had happened to me. I knew these people. I considered some of them friends. I didn't understand what had happened. My best friend was there and people I knew. I couldn't completely wrap my brain around it because I was so traumatized. But the woman said, you know, you really need to go to the hospital and you need to get a rape kit because there may be a point when you want to have this evidence and you're going to need it. And my mom agreed and she said, please, let's go to the hospital. And so I agreed to go. On the way to the hospital, I thought about what these men had done to me. I thought about all four of them around me, one raping me while the others waited their turn, high-fiving each other and laughing over my body. And I felt like I wanted to die. And on the ride to the hospital, not only did I feel like I wanted to die, it became obvious to me that I needed to die. I had two small sons at the time, 4 and 5. And I thought, you know, I can't die because of them. But then I thought, yeah, I can, because I'm disgusting. I'm broken. I'm damaged. And they're going to be ashamed of me. So not even the thought of my children made me feel like I should stay alive. I felt like I needed to die. The only thing I thought about at that point was how could I kill myself and make sure my kids didn't find my body. We continued on to the Salem Hospital. I decided to do the rape kit for my mom because I wanted her to be proud of me and I didn't want to upset her any more than I already had. While I was at the hospital, I met Nurse Jenny. And for whatever reason, Nurse Jenny had this profound effect upon me. And I began praying while I was at the hospital. And God told me that I had a purpose to be on this planet, that I needed to take care of my children, and that I was to be a nurse and help other people. So in between getting pictures taken of my entire body, including the physical injuries to my vagina, having my pubic hairs plucked, detailing the graphicness of the event, basically being re-traumatized again by the medical process. In between all of these things, I was asking Jenny how to become a nurse. Where do I go to school? How do I get this done? What do I do? And 2 months later, I was in school, and I'm now a nurse. I have a bachelor's, I have a master's in healthcare administration, and I thank God for Jenny every day, because this event could have killed me. And for some victims, it does. They die. Or they're living, and they're living with depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, eating disorders, drug addictions. Families are ruined. Children are hurt in the crossfire. And I've lived all this. I know what all of this is. 2 weeks after I got the rape kit, when I decided I wanted to live, I also wanted to press charges. I wanted to hold these men accountable for what they did to me. And I spoke with the police. I gave my statement and I said, yes, let's get the ball rolling. Let's get these men. And they were arrested, they were charged. They were charged with rape, sodomy, unlawful sexual penetration, on and on and on. They were all facing, I think, at least 20 years in prison. The evidence that was collected, statements were taken, the whole deal. Everything was moving forward. And it wasn't until, well, probably a few days after they were arrested, the backlash started, and it was severe. My best friend told me that she would not support me. She would testify against me if she had the opportunity. She did not feel that the men deserved to go to prison for what they did to me. The boyfriend I had at the time was friends with one of my rapists. He also felt that his friend did not deserve to go to prison for what he did to me. The community, the media, it was your typical, she's lying. And I was suffering, my family was suffering, I received death threats that my children were going to be killed if I moved forward. And I began having to really think about, do I want to do this? And the district attorney at the time told me that my case would be difficult. I would have to go through four trials. It essentially was a he said, she said case. And when I took that information and I weighed the pros and the cons. That's what we do when we make decisions. We think about the pros and the cons. And I thought, well, am I really going to risk my sanity, my children's lives, destroy my family and place us in the public for everyone to scrutinize and talk about for a case that I probably can't even win? Because that's what the DA was telling me. I didn't have a case. So I dropped it, and I retreated to a life of shame and confusion and all the after effects of rape, depression, borderline eating disorder, self-loathing, self-hate, the whole thing. And it wasn't until, and mind you, during this time when I dropped the charges, the men just kind of went on with their lives. Calvin Carlisle and Jason Dandridge stayed at OSU and continued to play football on a full ride scholarship. So while I was on welfare, trying to figure out how to get through school with my two sons, their education was completely paid for. But anyways, it wasn't until this last December that I came forward with my story to speak about it because I felt like I couldn't live with it any longer, that John Canzano did an in-depth investigation into my case and found out that there was plenty of evidence for a prosecution. It was not a he said, she said case. The DA at the time admitted that she did not need my testimony, that she could have moved forward without me. The city of Corvallis, I guess, essentially, DA, Attorney General, OSU, they all prioritized two athletes' careers over my life, basically. And unfortunately now, almost 17 years later, I find all this information out, and I think, oh, well, what can I do about it? Nothing. I can't do anything about it. Number one, the statute of limitations is up, so I can't prosecute. And there's nothing I can do about the DA that misinformed me, essentially lied to me and didn't take my case. There's nothing I can do about the police that destroyed my evidence after 2 years. It didn't even keep my evidence for the 6 years. Essentially what people are saying to me is like, well, we're sorry we broke the law, but oh well. It's been a long time ago, sorry. That's what I get for all this. And it's frustrating. But the statute of limitations is supposed to protect people like me. Statute of limitations should protect all victims and every crime of sexual violence is different, like Danielle Tudor said. And the statute of limitations has to be long enough to cover everything. I deserve justice. There's no reason I shouldn't. And there are others like me. Danielle Tudor deserves justice. Jenny Ewing deserves justice. All victims deserve justice. And if the statute of limitations, as it is right now, is not doing that, then we need to change it so that it does, so that it covers all victims. We should not be protecting perpetrators. We should be protecting victims. That's what this law is for. It's for me. And I am one person and one voice, but I sit here before you representing thousands of survivors and victims, thousands of family members, thousands of children like my sons. And quite frankly, I realized this morning that I'm the majority. I am the majority that believes that sexual violence is not okay and that perpetrators should serve for their crimes. And I believe that even if you're not a victim, you also believe that. We all believe that the victims deserve justice. And so I would ask that you please extend the statute of limitations so that you don't have another Brenda Tracy here next year testifying before you. And thank you for taking the time to listen to me. I so very much appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll be brief. I know you've heard a lot of testimony today. But after hearing Brenda's story, I think what I'd like you to take away from this is that given how horrific this crime was, she has no remedy either civilly or criminally. If there was ever a case where she should have a remedy, it would be this case. There's also no question that this happened, and it happened like she just described. I've read the police reports, I've looked at the witness statements, and it's clear it happened just as she explained it. These four men basically confessed, they implicated each other, and the physical evidence was clearly there. Even though this case is 16 years later, it could still be proven next week. But she doesn't have a remedy either civilly or criminally. She doesn't have a remedy in the criminal system because the statute of limitations is 6 years. She doesn't have a remedy under state law in the state of Oregon because of the statute of limitations in abuse cases. She doesn't get the advantage of the childhood sexual abuse that has an extended statute of limitations and allows you to bring a case civilly 20, 30, 40, or 50 years later. That statute doesn't apply to Brenda because she was an adult when this happened. My practice is representing victims of childhood sexual abuse. Most of my clients are 40 or 50 or 60 years old today. Their crimes occurred, their offenses occurred when they were 10, 12, 14 years old. I bring those cases in states all across the country and in Portland. And I'm able to do that because of the extended statute of limitation for a civil case. And so I know what it's like to bring a case that's old, that's 20, 30, 40 years old. And I'll tell you that I've never had a problem finding the witnesses, finding the documents, finding the evidence that I need. I can't remember a case yet that I have declined because it was so old that I couldn't find the evidence. The argument that the prosecutor will be hampered because the case is so old and they won't be able to prove their case, I reject that for a number of reasons. The primary reason is that the prosecutor has got the burden of proof. And if the prosecutor has the burden of proof, and if there's been passage of time or there's been loss of evidence, it's going to disproportionately impact the prosecution because they have the burden of proof. Same thing in my cases on childhood sexual abuse. If there's going to be an impact based on the passage of time, it's going to be on the person prosecuting the case, whether it's the prosecutor in a criminal case or it's the plaintiff's attorney in a civil case. And like I said, I've had no problem finding the evidence, finding the witnesses, finding the documents, finding the physical evidence. I try cases all the time that are 20 or 30 years old. The Oregon legislature has already recognized the fact in ORS 12117 that childhood sexual abuse is different and that we need to let these people reflect on this to get the counseling they need to actually discover the impact on them and discover the causal connection between the impact and the crime itself. And so we give, in the civil arena, people up until they're 40 years old or even beyond that if they didn't yet know the connection between the crime and the impact. There's really no difference for adults when they're facing, when they've been raped. They have the same impact. They have the same difficulty in coming forward. Brenda's experience here is not atypical. In fact, it's very typical. Somebody who suffered a trauma like rape oftentimes has difficulty facing it. They have guilt, they have shame, they have self-blame. They're worried they're not going to be believed. And so it takes them a while to get the courage and to get the fortitude to come forward. And Brenda was able to do that after 16 years. I have many clients who are able to do that only after 10, 15, 20 years. I would urge you to pass the statute of limitations, to extend it to at least 20 years, and make sure that people like Brenda have a remedy, both civilly and criminally. Thank you.
Chairman Barker, who stepped out for
he
a moment.
Stepped out. Don't just
My name is Jacqueline Swanson. I'm with O'Donnell Clark and Crew, along with Steve. I also represent Brenda, who is just an amazing woman with such a passion for change and advocacy for other survivors, and I greatly respect her. So I'm proud to be here with her today. Before I became an attorney, I was actually a sexual assault victim advocate for 6+ years. I did that work in California and then to a lesser extent here in Oregon because I was in law school, so there wasn't a whole lot of time, unfortunately. But I can confirm once again from my experience that all of the stories that you're hearing today from these brave survivors who are stepping forward and sharing what was one of the most horrendous experiences in their life, that this is not unusual. It's not atypical. You know, there are a number of difficulties inherent to sexual assault and rape, which make it very difficult for survivors to come forward and report immediately. Steve has mentioned a few of these: anxiety, guilt, shame, self-blame. Brenda has illustrated a number of them as well. The backlash, fear of retaliation, alienating your family and friends. There are a number of considerations that a sexual assault survivor is forced to weigh when she's deciding whether or not to report the crime to the police. The law has already recognized in a number of other circumstances that it is difficult for victims to make this decision, and indeed only 26% of victims ever report their crime to the police. The reasons why they don't report are these exact same reasons that we gave here: shame, anxiety, fear of retaliation, disbelief, over and over again. They need time in order to come to terms with what happened to them. They need time in order to come to terms with how they're going to integrate the criminal process into their life. In 2005, the federal government reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act, and in it they provided for anonymous reporting of sexual assaults in order to collect sexual assault forensic examinations. Over and over again, we've seen increases in reporting for victims who can come forward and feel that they have a safe space where they can get their rape kit, they can wait while it is safely secured in evidence, and then come back at a later date when they are more emotionally and physically able to do it in order to go through the criminal process. Most people who support traditional statutes of limitations will often cite to efficiency of justice and fairness, but how can denying justice to an entire class of people like Brenda, like Jenny, like Danielle, how can that possibly be said to promote justice and fairness? We recognize here in Oregon that there is no statute of limitations for homicide. Ostensibly, we recognize that because we believe that it is against the public interest to afford a perpetrator of murder a shield of time behind which they can stand and not be held accountable for their crimes. Chief Justice Berger in 1977 said, short of homicide, rape is the ultimate violation of the self. Why should crimes of rape be treated any differently? Why should victims of sexual assault, who are protected by Oregon constitutional guarantees of victims' rights to fairness, dignity, respect, and participation in the criminal justice system, why should they be afforded any different rights? I'm here today to testify in support of this bill, extending it to at least 20 years, but preferably indefinitely, like two dozen other jurisdictions who have done the same. And the reason I'm in support of it is because I support victims and I support their experiences. And I think that our state, the state of Oregon, also has an interest in saying that we recognize the pain and the trauma that these victims go through. We recognize its significance and how courageous you have to be in order to come forward. Extending the statute of limitations sends a message, and it sends a message to these victims that their cases matter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions, Ms. Brown? Thank you very much. Christine?
Chair Barker, committee members, I'll be quick because those women said most of what I was going to say.
Okay, thank you.
And the man, too. So today I'm here doing the scariest thing I've ever had to do because I know it will open the door to intense attacks from my abuser, but that's something most victims are already too familiar with. I have to deal with it in particularly in a way because I actually right now have to deal with him being out on the streets and...
I'm sorry, you need to give your name.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm just nervous, so I start
that's
going.
Right. That's right.
All right, my name's Christine Van Order.
Thank you.
And I'm nobody. I don't have a bunch of lobby groups behind me. I don't have an attorney. I'm just nobody. And the fact that I can get in front of people who make the laws that affect our state, I think it's just amazing that we live in a country
you're
like that.
You're not nobody to us. You're
sorry, what?
You're somebody very important.
Well.
You're my constituent.
A long time ago, I was made to feel very unimportant, and I think that a lot of people were. I was listening to you read it. It says that, now, am I to hear you correctly, that if someone is raped, like, less than 20 years ago, they can still be prosecuted if they were a minor?
So depending on whether or not the person is a minor and depending on which period of time we choose, it may occur that they turn 30, later than the period of time that we're giving them the benefit for the statute of limitations. So the intention there is to give that person the greatest benefit possible if they're a minor.
What about in cases where there's like DNA or video evidence? I mean, with technology, you know, we've heard of other attacks being recorded. What about cases of like that?
Well, we have a law in the books that has no limit for DNA cases. So as you heard some testimony about.
Okay. Well, right now, I'm proud to be an Oregonian, and I know you guys all know why I'm here, probably, and you can just read what I submitted later, because a lot of that stuff is said, and I'm sure it's not the last time that someone's been in front of a committee or a panel or a task force and has been asking for justice. I was told that the whole reason why statute of limitations can't go retroactive, even in the cases of DNA and video evidence, is because of the cost. And I haven't seen any evidence that our system would just all of a sudden be overloaded with a million victims, just overloading our system, you know, at the prosecutorial level. For one, because there are way too many obstacles right now keeping victims from going forward, so there's no evidence to suggest that opening it up even wider and giving more victims, that even if there's a very small percentage of people willing to come forward, there's just no evidence that suggests it would be a financial burden, you know, that we couldn't handle. I just think that we're smart enough. And I think that we're dedicated enough as Oregonians, then we get accused of being progressive. And I think that's not necessarily a bad thing, especially in the area of victims' rights, especially because, I mean, we're second only to Indiana right now when it comes to statute of limitations. And that's like, that's just kind of embarrassing right now. But my discussions with especially male survivors of child sexual abuse, a lot of the recurring theme is that they equate homosexuality with pedophilia. And so it does not surprise me that as certain people get older and they start to understand what really happened, that they don't start taking this really hard line, you know, view of certain people. But, you know, maybe I'm seeing a connection just because of people I've met that have kind of influenced that. But I just think that people who commit crimes against children, who commit these heinous crimes, I think they're in a class all their own. I think that they need to be prosecuted in a very impactful and meaningful way. A meaningful way, because, you know, just listening to what Brenda said about, you know, her experience with the district attorney, I was made aware quite a few years ago that, you know, some of the judges and district attorneys got together and said, oh, Measure 11's, you know, making our prisons overflow. We need to really curb down our sentencing and everything like that. I think that's probably, you know, we need to get together and figure out how to do this. And I think maybe there were some crimes that just weren't pursued, because honestly, where would you put them if you got a hold of them all? And that's kind of what I see as like the really, when you get down to the nitty gritty, it's that there really is a fear of the cost of pursuing justice, simply because it's so expensive to house, you know, these adults in custody once they've been, you know, arrested and prosecuted and all that. So, you know, I just, you know, want to thank you guys for all that you do. And I just want to just encourage you to take everything that these women say and about, you know, what they go through is, I mean, just on the process, you know, just, it's a process for me just to go anywhere. I take my dog that I usually wake up from a nap, and he walks around the house with me. And I check my doors, my windows, I make sure my car is locked when I'm sure that there's no one lurking outside my house. I get in my car, I check the rearview mirror just to make sure that I don't see the man of my nightmares in the rearview mirror, because of what I've had to go through is more than, it's traumatizing to talk about it and hear about it. I mean, the vicarious trauma that these district attorneys and these prosecutors go through just to prosecute a case and then to not get a conviction, I can feel what they would probably feel. But when there is a chance for justice to work, I just think that we should take that opportunity and let it run its course. So, thank you.
Thank you very much for your coming in today. We appreciate it. You aren't nobody. Gail, Meyer, and Lisa, please.
Mr. Chair, with the Chair's permission, we would request the opportunity to make our statements at another time. It's definitely longer than anything we would want to truncate and just compress, so.
Okay. We are at the 5 o'clock hour. We can't move the bill today. We don't have the paperwork, but we so.
Can carry it tomorrow just for.
Okay, we'll carry it over just for your testimony.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that very much.
And then we will be moving an amendment.
Okay. With. I'm sorry. My witness is Lisa Maxfield. She has a court appearance at 1:30 in Washington County tomorrow, and so Is it too late to ask that it be that we have our testimony given on Tuesday or Wednesday?
We'll have to repost. We can't carry it that far, so we'll have to take a look at the agenda.
We'll have to repost it. I can't just carry it over from here. It'll have to be posted for a later hearing, but we will do that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. And I have other people have to leave. I have other meetings. So we'll have to leave this unfinished today, and I will adjourn the meeting.
Well, we have 2660. We'll either have to carry the work session or work it right now. Okay.
2660 is ready to go. I'll close the public hearing on Hospital 2317 and quickly open a work session on House Bill 2660.
It is. And Chair Barker, members of the committee, just really quick, 2660 comes to us from Representatives Olson and Senator Przanski. This bill was heard on March 12 of 2015. We have a -3 amendment before us today. The amendment makes the threshold for installation of an ignition interlock device 0.08 BAC. If the BAC is 0.08 and above, The device is mandatory if the BAC is below a 0.08, but there is another substance found as a result of a chemical test. The device is also mandatory. Should a test reveal that a BAC is less than a 0.08 BAC with no other substance revealed other than alcohol, the installation of the device is up to the court's discretion, and we are ready to move the bill today.
Is that a change in the wording of the original bill?
It is. It is now.
It was confusing in the original bill.
Yes, it is now permissive for the court to.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I know it's late. We all want to leave. However, if I'm about to vote on it, I need to follow up.
Right.
If I may, Council. So, can you explain what this is changing exactly from relative to existing law?
Relative to existing law.
Yeah.
So, relative to existing law, right now we don't have this BAC threshold for the.
Let's pretend somebody blows a 0.05, but they are proven beyond a reasonable doubt to be adversely impacted to a noticeable and perceptible degree.
Right.
Is that the case?
Yeah.
Under that situation right now, which probably doesn't happen that often, it is now required. And this bill would make it permissive. Is that correct?
This would allow court discretion in that
instance.
Very well.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go along with the amendment, but just so you know, I intend to vote against this bill after we're moving it to the floor.
Wait, can I understand what just happened? The current law requires an interlock under all circumstances.
That's right.
This takes away some of those circumstances. Mm-hmm.
The current interlock law requires that as part of diversion you install an ignition interlock device. The bill that we have before us right now would allow a court discretion only in certain circumstances, and that would be when it is an alcohol-only case and the blow is below a 0.08 BAC.
May I ask a clarifying question?
Absolutely.
What about a situation involving dissipation of time, for example? Let's pretend there's an arrest on Mount Hood at, say, 5 p.m. Person appears to be impaired. After a trip to the hospital, the blow doesn't happen until 4 hours later when it's a 0.07 blow.
That's when back extrapolation would be used in that instance.
Would there be discretion under this bill?
Well, I would anticipate that the district attorney's office would argue there is no discretion because back extrapolation would put that person at above a 0.08 BAC at the time the arrest occurred, and then it would be up to the judge to, number one, rule as a threshold matter whether or not they've met that burden, and then, number two, make a decision as to whether or not they think there should be an IID device.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
Representative Springer had her hand.
Representative Springer, did you?
Well, I guess a couple things. The first thing is, as I look at the bill, we're not changing anything else. There are absolutely no other changes in sentencing or the possibility of any particular sentencing discretion.
That's correct. The only other thing that we're addressing is a combination theory where somebody may have a below a 0.08 BAC, but there's also another substance on board, so they are impaired with a combination of substances. In that case, an interlock device would be required in every instance.
Follow up. If they're below a 0.8 and there's the presence of another substance, then an interlock device would be required?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if somebody was impaired by oxycodone and then also had two drinks, there's something called additive effects in the law, and what that says is that the combination of those two drugs increases the impairment over and above what you would have if you were just had two drinks and that's where you were. So as a result of that, you would have an interlock device installed.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
That's true of existing law, correct?
We can carry it to tomorrow, too, if we want to have the full.
I'd love to read that amendment.
Okay, we'll carry it over. Good. I'll close the work.
That's the dash trees we're talking about. Putting
set the work session over in House Bill 2660. I'm going to adjourn the meeting. I'm late for a meeting. So 2660. I'm going to adjourn.